This is the ASCII Paw 2010 Keep Coming Back panel. My name is Carl, and I'm an alcoholic.
Lots and lots and lots, and whole bunches. Okay.
That's the only reason why I came here, so I'm glad that even at this early hour, you folks were willing to put in the effort. Welcome to the Keep Coming Back panel of the 18th Arizona State Conference of Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous. Please help me open this meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. This is our anonymity statement. Out of respect for our anonymity, please do not take photographs during any of the meetings of ASCII Paw. The taking of photos during AA meetings makes many members uncomfortable about the confidentiality of the gathering. Also, please be considerate when taking photographs around conference venues. Take care that you do not capture images of AA members, family members, and friends who did not give permission and may not wish to appear in published pictures. You may interview us and our friends, but our full names and our pictures as AA members cannot be broadcast, filmed, or publicly printed. Please do not post recognizable photos of identifiable AA members on news websites. Whatever the medium, no disclosure of a member's affiliation with AA can be made by anyone but the individual. Here to read an excerpt from Chapter 3 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, help me welcome Elizabeth.
Oh, I'm short.
Good morning. I'm Elizabeth. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Elizabeth. We love you, Elizabeth. Lots and lots and lots. In whole bunches.
Thank you. Love you, too. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? Of what is he thinking? Our first example is a friend. We shall call him Jim. This man has a charming wife and a family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He had a commendable World War record. He is a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He is an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated that he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us. We told him what we knew of alcoholism and the answer we had found. He made a beginning. His family was reassembled, and he began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. All went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. To his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with him, reviewing carefully what had happened. He agreed he was a real alcoholic and in a serious condition. He knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family, for whom he had a deep affection. Yet he got drunk again. We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is his story. I came to work on Tuesday morning. I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. Then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. I had no intention of drinking. I just thought I would get a sandwich. I also had the notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar, for I had been going to it for years. I had eaten there many times during the months I was sober. I sat down at a table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still no thoughts of drinking, I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured as I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. The experiment went so well that I ordered another whiskey and poured it into more milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. Thus started one more journey to the asylum for Jim. Here was the threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing of that intense mental and physical suffering which drinking always caused him. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if he only mixed it with milk. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call his plan insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? You may think this an extreme case. To us, it is not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always the curious mental phenomenon that parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea went out. Next day, we would ask ourselves, in all earnestness and sincerity, how it could have happened.
Thanks, Elizabeth. All right. Help me welcome Ray, who's going to be reading the 12 traditions.
My name is Ray. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ray. We love you, Ray. Lots and lots and lots in whole bunches.
Thanks. The 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Great, thank you, Rick. And our first speaker is from Phoenix. Please help me welcome Chris.
Chris, thanks for showing up.
We do
lots and lots and lots and lots. Whole bunches.
Yes, I like that. How much time do I have?
30 minutes.
Are you serious?
or less.
It's a, and I had like 10.
It's a feel like thing. Do what you feel like.
All right, all right, all right. So yeah, I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really glad to be here this morning. I'm always honored to do anything when I'm asked to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. Makes you feel like yeah, it might have something to offer somebody, and that's really cool. That's really different. Keep coming back. I guess you get asked to share on that topic because you've relapsed a bunch. I have. So I'm in the right meeting for sure. You know, for me, whenever I speak, I always feel like the first thing I have to do is kind of qualify why I'm here, that I've earned my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. I definitely have. The Big Book talks about people drinking essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And that's me. That's why I drank. You know, I don't go too far into the childhood stuff, you know, like, oh, raised by a single mom, big deal. You know, nothing bad really happened to me as a kid, you know, broken home, but that's pretty common now. You know, I just think that I had the ism long before I ever took a drink, and I know I did, because my behavior, I remember being full of fear, full of anger as a kid, and that was just kind of my normal state of being as a child. And when I drank, it really did away with all that negative stuff, made me feel really good, and I wanted to do it again and again and again and again. And my first experience with alcohol was not necessarily a good one. I think we were stealing hood ornaments at that time. So we would go and steal hood ornaments off like Mercedes and Cadillacs. Those were the big things. I don't even think we did anything with them. Somebody might have made a necklace out of it, or I don't know what they did. But we would just, you know, basically deface property. And I drank Southern Comfort. And I don't think I drank a whole lot of it, but I drank enough to get real sick, you know, have a really good time and then get really sick. I've not drank Southern Comfort since that day. I've drank everything else, but, you know, it definitely took me out of whatever I was feeling at the time. And I've heard people kind of introduce themselves at meetings as escape artists, and I like that because that's what I am. Any type of negative emotion or really good emotion or anything emotional, I need to change that. And alcohol, for me, changes it immediately. And so, you know, 14, 15 started drinking, not too heavily. There are other substances in my story. I'll stick to alcohol, but there were things that I was doing daily that contributed to a lot of missed school. I think I missed like 63 days of my sophomore year of high school, which is not normal. Most people go more than that, and I got, you know, fights and all that stuff, and I was put into rehab at 15 years old. I lived in Texas, grew up in Texas, ended up in rehab in Provo, Utah, for 10 months when I was 15, and you know, absolutely not convinced that I'm an alcoholic. I'm a baby, you know, I love the part in the Big Book where it talks about seeing others drink with impunity. You know, all the other kids my age were kind of dabbling in drinking and drug use and all that stuff, and nothing was happening to them. But all of a sudden, I'm in rehab in another state, and it sucked bad. And you know, so that was my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 35 now, so I was 15 then. And I got out of rehab, and I was going to go to some meetings. And it was a year program, and I got out in 10 months. So it was a year minimum. So I'm a really good manipulator, a really good BSer. I can work the system and make you tell you whatever you want to hear to make you think that I'm okay. And that's what I did. And I got out early, and
I started going to some meetings because I thought that was, I actually thought that was kind of cool at the time. Like, nobody my age is doing this, you know, going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was telling people about, I gotta go to a meeting, I can't, you know. I can't go to that party, I've got this thing. It's a secret deal. And I think I was wearing like black dress socks with Birkenstocks back then. I was a very confused guy. And so I would go to these AA meetings and you know, in this little town in Texas, and it was smoky and all these old people that seemed, you know, some of them seemed happy, I guess, but most of them just seemed to be kind of crotchety and pissed off. A lot of talking about the problem, not much talk about the solution, although I didn't even know I needed a solution at the time. But we were talking about this. I don't really consider myself a young person anymore, so being at a young person's convention and all the kind of enthusiasm that's shown at the meetings, we were talking about it last night, and my fiance made a good point. She said, you know, that's what young people need today. Cause, and I remember back when I went to my first meetings, that was not a place I wanted to hang out. That was not a place I wanted to keep coming back to. I didn't relate to those people at all. And not to say that even if I would have gotten into a good group, I hadn't conceded to my innermost self yet that I'm an alcoholic. I had a lot more pain to go through, a lot more consequences, a lot more loss to go through before I could get to that point and stick around. But I'm really glad that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm very, very glad that it's everywhere. You know, and I'm glad people have, people like me have a place to go. You know, because, a little early, get emotional, escape artist. When I really reflect on it, like what a big deal it is that I found Alcoholics Anonymous, and looking at the life I have today because of it, it does get me emotional. You know, anyway, so from 15 to 28, it was just really a train wreck. This is a progressive disease. It gets worse, never better. I spent the next however many years that is trying to prove to myself and others that I'm not an alcoholic, and it almost killed me. You know, what happens to me when I drink is I can't stop. I put any kind of substance in my body, whether it be alcohol or anything else, and it creates a phenomenon of craving. And I obsess about it, and I have to have more. And the insanity of this disease, you know, I always kind of struggled with the second step, you know, am I insane? I didn't necessarily feel insane, you know, I'm not drooling and finger painting and, you know, shitting myself. I mean, you know, that's what I think of when I think of insanity. So really hard for me to talk about, you know, to really grasp the second step until somebody broke it down for me that the insanity of this disease is the thought that precedes the first drink. Given all the experience that I have drinking and the consequences that it produces, the fact that my mind can make me believe, yeah, you can have a drink, you can have one or two, you'll be all right, yeah, you can get back before anyone knows you're gone. You can, you know, all those thoughts that I've bought into, that I mean, that's nuts for me. And so you know, fast forward to 28 years old, I'm living in Colorado Springs. I've destroyed a relationship. Well, I've destroyed many relationships, but at that time, that was the significant relationship. And you know, sick, messed up relationship to begin with, but you know, I can remember being gone, going out for a burger. I'm gonna go to the drive-thru, come back, and I'd be gone for 3 days, literally, and no phone call, no nothing. Just shut that world out, go where I go to do what I do. And you know, that happened several times, and you know, the first few times I would come back and she was bananas. She was pissed, she was hurt, she was
you know, where the hell have you been? I was worried to death, blah, blah, blah. By the seventh or eighth time it happened, there was nothing. You know, there wasn't even, it was just indifference. And that's the, you know, that's that struck me, because that's somebody that's given up on you and just kind of throwing their hands up. And that's when it started to sink in that I was very much alone in this disease, that I was very much separated, beginning to be separated from all those anchors that kept me okay. And so I moved from Colorado Springs to Phoenix to get sober. Mom stepped in. I have a very awesome, enabling mom who was like, oh, please come stay with me. Oh, you're really, really sick? That's great. I like that. So am I, you know? So I came, and I, my big idea was to get sober here in Phoenix, Arizona, in Phoenix, Arizona. And I came here, and I didn't have a job. Basically had to be rescued from my own life. Started going to meetings. Wanted to be sober. I really did. I mean, my life had fallen apart. And got fired from a job I'd had for 7 years for stealing. And, you know, my life had absolutely fallen apart. So I did want to stop drinking. But that's all. You know, that I just didn't want to get some stuff back. I wanted to, I didn't have any concept of a real good life, how good it could actually be, so I didn't know what to hope for. But I saw in the rooms, when I would go to a meeting, I finally found some good meetings, and there were people in there that had this peace, you know, that had something that I didn't have, and they were smiling and laughing, and, you know, my life's in shambles, and I'm like, how do I get from here to there? It didn't seem possible to me. And they're talking about the steps, and I just didn't get it, you know, and I didn't have any tools to, I didn't do the things they suggested, bottom line. I didn't walk in there and get a sponsor. I didn't get in the middle of AA. I would sit in the back, leave early. I was scared as hell to really talk to anybody, unless it was to, you know, try to be funny and make an impression so they'd like me or whatever. But I definitely wasn't there for recovery. I really didn't have any idea what that was. And so I would go in and out, in and out, in and out. And what happened as a result of that was my life got worse and worse and worse. And that's the most astounding thing about being an alcoholic, I think, is that just when you think it can't get any worse, you can't, that emotionally, that dark, deep, just awful, terrible bankruptcy that you feel, when you think that can't get any worse, it does. There's a new low. I don't know anything like that. And, you know, the despair that I was feeling was terrible. And, you know, I ended up trading everything for a hit, everything for a drink. My car went, my job went, my house went, and I was living on the streets, and I was begging for money to get another drink. And I did that for months, and then I would come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd stay for 4 months or something, and my life would get a lot better. I would make an attempt to work the steps with a sponsor. I don't really think I withheld anything in my fourth or fifth step necessarily. No, that's not true. I did. I there were some things that I didn't put. I didn't do a thorough fourth and fifth step. And, you know, I'd get drunk again. And, you know, it that's all right. Anyway, fast forward, I got some stuff back. I'm in my apartment, living on my own. Went to a halfway house, did 89 days in my 90-day commitment. Moved out with my roommate from the halfway house, lived in an apartment. He relapsed, gave me the green light to go ahead and relapse. Because we were, you know, we were accountability buddies or whatever you call it. So that means I can So that means I can get drunk again. So I do. And 5 days later, you know, after my first drink, I'm in my apartment by myself deciding whether or not to kill myself. And you know, God intervened that day. I don't know. I was physically, it got bad so quick. Physically, I was literally on death's doorstep and all alone. And, you know, I guess for some reason in that moment, you know, I prayed to God and I really cried out to God and I said, you know, I don't know if I've got another one in me. And I really don't. Because getting sober is hard. You know, staying sober is hard. And that was my experience then. And I just kind of got an answer, you know, just give it one more shot. You know, and I dumped the booze, got rid of whatever else I had, called my mom. She came and literally, scooped me up off of my apartment floor Mother's Day of 2006. And I've been sober ever since then. And it's because I was done. And I conceded to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. The speaker last night talked about conceding to your innermost self that you have the kind of alcoholism that's described in the doctor's opinion in the big book. I have that, and I know that, and I know that it's never going to be different. I got a sponsor, started working the steps, and I kept coming back to meetings. When I didn't know what else to do, I would just go to a meeting. And I've always done that, you know, for 4.5 years now. I keep coming back, and this is where the solution is for me. And if you do keep coming back, I can tell you that I don't know if all the promises will come true in your life. A lot of them have for me. I met my future wife in AA. I've sponsored guys. You know, one of the guys that I sponsor just got sentenced to 8 months in prison, but he knew he was facing that time, and he stayed sober. You know, like, amazing. And I learned, you know, that maybe my job's not so bad, you know, that I can stay sober through anything. Just by taking another guy through the steps, you know? So, keep coming back. I'm going to freaking bawl if I keep talking. So. I appreciate you being here, and I pass.
Great, thank you, Chris. Our next speaker is from Las Vegas, Nevada. Please help me welcome Carrie Ann.
Good morning, my name's Carrie Ann, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Carrie Ann.
I'm gonna stand.
We love you, Carrie Ann.
We love you.
Lots and lots and lots. In whole bunches.
Thank you. I was gonna say I'm just gonna stand because I don't know if I can talk as long for so like as loud for so long. Without like probably hacking up a lung. So I guess I'm just gonna start from the beginning. My parents actually are alcoholics. I was raised in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was the baby that was being passed around in meetings, like that everyone was all excited about. And like my parents were the token AA family, and they met in rehab, and it was great. And what basically happened is my mom stayed sober the whole time and my dad could never keep more than a year together. So growing up, I got to see both sides. And I got to see what alcoholism was and what it could do, and I got to see like what it was like if like you were practicing a program and you were doing the things that you needed to do to stay sober. And having that other side, like having my dad and having like walking home to like heroin needles laying on the ground and like him rolling his eyes that I'm actually home, like I knew that I didn't want to be anything like him, and it was a big fear for me. And so for a long time that was my motivation, and I never did pick up a drink. But when I turned 14, like something in my curiosity got the best of me, and I just wanted to know like what it was. What it was that for so many years he would choose drugs and alcohol over our family. I just felt like I needed to know. And so I took my first drink, and what happened is like I felt calm inside. And all of this resentment that I had towards my dad, it slipped out the window. Like, I got it. I understood. And I was no longer mad at him. And a lot of people, at least where we're from, they talk about, like, it was fun, and then it was fun and problems, and it was just problems. My experience is, like, it was never a party. I was, like, a drink alone in the corner of the room. If you wanted to come, you were welcome. But I could care less if you were going to be there. And it literally became my daily goal within probably about 2 weeks to be drinking every day. I made quick friends with the bums that lived down the, like, on the beach. I grew up in Hawaii. And so I would just go find whoever I could and have them buy me a pint of vodka and a couple 40s. And that's just how it was. It wasn't... Sometimes I wish I had, like, these fun stories, but, like, that's not my experience. There was never, like, the excitement and the fun and partying that a lot of people talk about. But, I don't know, it progressively got worse, and I was old enough to get a car, and my mom got me a car, and her being in AA, we always had this, like, awesome, honest, open relationship where I tell her everything, and so I told her I tried drinking, and I told her I tried smoking a little pot, and she asked me, like, how I felt about it, and I was like, well, I don't like drinking, but I probably will smoke a little weed, you know, and that was a full-out lie. Like, I was drinking every day, and what she basically told me is that you're not allowed to drink and drive. Like, I'll take your car. And okay, no problem, but I was never really good at following instructions or following rules or being honest, and I was driving drunk every night. And it got to the point one night where I was driving in a blackout, and I did make it home, I don't know how. And I made it up into my room, and she came up, I guess I had left my light on, and she came to wake me up to tell me to turn my light off, and I was, like, fully passed out, like, eyes in the back of the head, not responsive, and she goes back and forth from being codependent to not codependent, and that night she just left me there, and she made a couple calls in the morning, and when I woke up, like, I wasn't sure if she knew or if I was in trouble or what was happening, but she said we had to have a talk. And the talk, she gave me an ultimatum. What she basically said is that I could keep my car and go to an outpatient treatment center, or I could give her my keys and just keep going on the path that I was going on. And by this point, it had been a couple years, and drinking wasn't working for me anymore. I wasn't getting drunk anymore. I was just blacking out. I wasn't able, you know, to get... I wasn't able to get that, like, relief and sense of comfort and, like, that comes from taking a drink. It wasn't working anymore. It became a necessity. And so my, conniving self was like, okay, so this is what we'll do. I'll go to your little rehab program, and I'll stop drinking for the 90 days, and then I'll have my car, and when I get out, it'll work again. Because that's all I ever wanted it to do. I wanted it to work. And so I started going to this program, and I was really going to give it my best shot, you know? I was really just going to be done for right now. And when I got into that treatment center, I met a lot of kids that were doing a lot of worse things than I was doing. And I justified to start doing what they were doing because it wasn't alcohol, and I really was not drinking for this, you know, period of time. And it got really bad really quick. I started coming up with a bunch of, like, dirty... you know, dirty drug tests and lying about what it was and saying it must have been that, you know, ingredients in my asthma inhaler, like, total just, like, in denial. Like, I was in denial. Like, if you would have asked me, I believed what I was saying. Like, they're, you know, like, they're going to believe what I'm saying. Like, this, like, not me. This can't be me. And in this program that I was in, after you get three of these, you know, dirty drug tests, you get sent to a residential treatment center on another island, and I didn't want to go, and it was a long program. It was a two-year program, and I was really scared, and growing up in Hawaii, I mean, like, I grew up with, like, light blonde hair and blue eyes, and I always really fit in, but I knew, like, if I got sent to this program, like, I was going to be the girl that got picked on, like, and I really didn't want to get beat up, and I was really scared, and so... after I got, like, you know, the amount of tests before I got sent off, it was kind of like my last shot. And so I decided I was really going to give it a try, like, not do anything and do AA, at least until I turned 18. Because when I was 18, nobody could send me anywhere, and I could do what I wanted to do, and it would be okay. And so I did, you know, like I my first sobriety date was October 13th, 2000. I still remember it. I started going to meetings. I got a sponsor. I do like 1, 2, 3 and like switch my sponsor. And then I do 1, 2, 3 again and I switch my sponsor. And I kind of show up late, you know, like talk during the meetings, go outside to smoke when the speaker's talking. I really wasn't doing the things that are necessary for me to keep my seat here in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was able to put, you know, a little over a year together. And I think I did just enough to get by. And I'm really glad that we read that, that you read that reading in the beginning, because that's exactly my experience. I mean, it wasn't whiskey and milk, but what had happened is I didn't change like my old playmates, my playthings, like my playgrounds, anything. And I sat back and I was able to watch my friends taking the drinks with impunity that I couldn't take that. And I went to hang out with my friend one night, and it was her and her boyfriend. It was all the way out in the middle of nowhere. And they were drinking, and the thought came that, like, I could do this. Like, it'll be okay, and nobody's going to know. And, you know, like, I'm not going to get sent away. They can't test me for alcohol. And I thought I could just have a couple drinks. And my experience is I can never just have a couple drinks. Just like the book talks about, like, I have little control over the amount I take, always. And I remember maybe taking the first shot. I honestly remember nothing of that night. It gets worse, never better. Definitely my experience. Thought I could have fun. I don't even remember what happened. And having that year beforehand, like I wasn't necessarily ready to get sober, but I was hearing a lot of the things that were getting me towards that preparation of being ready to be done. And when I woke up, I remembered, like, hearing that. Like, not knowing what was happening, like, I took a drink, and before I knew it, like, I was drunk again, and I was off and running. And so, that morning I drove home, and I felt, you know, just awful, and I didn't want to tell anybody, and so I didn't. I kept showing up to meetings, I kept claiming that I had the same sobriety date, and that's probably why it sticks so like good in my mind, because I claimed it for a really long time. I thought you guys would care. I thought it was important. I thought I would let you down. I was still scared about being sent away. You know, like I really just thought I was that important, that it was that big of a deal. And it started to eat me up inside. It really did. And I don't even remember what coin I took, maybe like 2 years, and it was at the big Saturday night speaker meeting and everyone's clapping, and I sit back down and my friend flips over the coin and she points on the back to the part where it says, "To thine own self be true." And I didn't know, like, if she knew, like, we know. I mean, we usually know, like, if somebody is not sober, but, you know, like, I kept up the lie. I wasn't ready yet, you know, like, it wasn't my time, but I definitely got a sponsor, and I started working the steps again, and I was honest to the best of my ability, leaving out the part that I wasn't really as sober as I was, and I got the awesome opportunity. Young People's in Hawaii is really strong, and everyone was going to Kentucky, where they were having Icky Paw that year. And a whole big group of us went, and I got to find like that excitement and that fire for Alcoholics Anonymous, and just like what you're sharing about earlier, where it's really important to have these events to show people that we can have fun in sobriety, and like, you know, to do the things that still make us happy, and we're not a glum lot. And I got to experience that firsthand, and I was on fire. I was on the pink cloud, you know. And I got to go back to LA and hang out with a friend for a little while. And I got home and I met him. And this is where my mom's codependence comes in. He had 2 weeks sober, and he was homeless and living on the beach. And my mom let him move in with us. And it was love. We were together for a while. We actually ended up getting married, and after about 2 years, and I thought, like, all right, this AA thing works, you know, like my life is going great, like got my job, got my husband, like life is good. And I don't know. What happened is, like, we decided to keep our program separate. Like, I'm not going to take your inventory. You're not going to take my inventory. You know, like, do your work, and, like, God comes first. The only thing with that is, like, you never know if they're really doing it or not. And he said he was meeting with his sponsor. I'm not really sure. But what happened is we decided to move to Las Vegas. And I was still lying about my sobriety. I didn't tell anybody, not even my husband, not my best friend, not anybody. Nobody knew. And we picked up and we moved across the ocean, drove up to Las Vegas. And I experienced, I think, what a lot of people experience. I didn't like the way they did it. I thought they did it different than we did, and they didn't do it right. And at the end, we just say stay instead of like keep coming back. and I thought that was all wrong. Like, how could you not chant at the end of the meeting? So what happened is I went to these different meetings all over the valley, and what my experience, my personal experience, is that I wasn't new, so people weren't like, oh, it's the new girl, you know. And I just kind of, I didn't really feel like I fit in, and so I just confined myself to going to this little small meeting that was held four nights a week out in, you know, Henderson, which is a part of Las Vegas. I guess it'd be like Phoenix and Scottsdale. But it was full of old people that didn't like to do things. Friday night was the big night where we'd go out to IHOP after the meeting. And I was just getting miserable. And in the meantime, my husband, he wasn't going to meetings at all. He was working, and he didn't like the way they did it either. And, you know, nothing was... That excitement that like we once had for Alcoholics Anonymous, it was gone. And I got a sponsor when I moved, but it was so I could tell my friends at home that I had a sponsor. I didn't call her, I didn't work any steps with her. I would go to a couple meetings here and there, basically because I had nothing else to do, because I had no friends. I was really losing my faith in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what had happened is my husband started drinking again. He started not coming home for days at a time, weeks at a time, drinking in the house. And I was losing it, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And like for me, my experience is there's been these little points in my sobriety that are like, okay, if I could just get through to this point, you know? Like some people say take it a day at a time. I kind of felt like I took it an event at a time, like until I turn 18. Well, when I turn 18, then, you know, like everything was okay. And then, well, then I got married, so I'm like, well, I guess we're gonna stay sober now. Like that's what we do, you know? And I was miserable, and I didn't know what to do. And I got on the phone with a good friend who I had gotten sober with. And she could hear it in my voice, and she knew I wasn't in a really good place. And ICKIPA, the international conference, happened to be in LA that year. And she called a couple of our friends, and she told me, like, I don't care how you get down here. Like, we have a registration for you, and we have a room for you, and you just need to get here. And so I got off of work on Friday, and I put gas on my credit card that I couldn't afford, and I drove down there. And I got to get that, like, rejuvenation in my spirit for AA, and, like, know that everything was going to be okay. And I got to be surrounded by all the people that were there when I first got sober, and they're able to, like, love me and tell, you know, like, I could be okay with what was going on. And I heard my friend shared a really good analogy once of, like, Alcoholics Anonymous is like baby penguins. I'm going to tell you guys. So what the penguins do, because it's so cold, you'll get it, it's a good story. What the penguins do because it's so cold is that all the ones that are warm from the inside, they go to the outside and they start warming the other ones. And it's like this perpetual cycle. And so when the warm ones are in the middle and they're all warmed up again, they get to go to the outside and repeat the process. And for me, that's just a really great example of what Alcoholics Anonymous is, and it's a really great example of what my experience in sobriety has been. I'm not always, you know, like the strongest member of AA. I don't always have my shit together, but when I don't, there's the people there to like love me back to health and to show me the way, you know, show me through their actions what to do. And when I do the work and I'm able to pass that on to other people, that's what we do. And so I was outside of ICKIPA on the last day, it was Sunday, and I saw a guy that I had met in Las Vegas. And I was still resentful at all the Las Vegas people, but I decided to go up to him. And I was like, hey, aren't you that guy? Like, didn't you meet me? You know? And he was like, oh yeah, your husband's, you know. And I'm like, yeah. He's like, yeah, I would call him all the time, but he seemed more interested with work. And what I got to see is like Alcoholics Anonymous in its true action. Like men were reaching out to men, and there were women reaching out to me. It just wasn't the way that I thought it, you know, like should be. My opinions, they typically get me in trouble. And so that resentment started to fade. And when I got back, he got me connected on getting involved in LIVIPA, which is the Las Vegas Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous. The first meeting I went to was their wrap-up inventory meeting. It was great. But I had been around before. I'd served on lots of committees, you know, in Hawaii and different conferences. And so I didn't mind, and I just felt like I had found my people again. And so that sponsor that I got when I first moved there, and I didn't call her, I started calling her, and we started going through the book. And I really, like, thoroughly started working my steps. And it was a little bit before that, when I was in that desperation, I was praying to God about, like, what do you want me to do? I don't know what to do. Like, I'm scared, and I feel like there's something. And it came to me that, like, I'm lying about my sobriety date. Like, this was still going on, okay? And so I told a couple key people, like my mother and my husband and my sponsor. And other than that, like, I didn't really know anybody, so I didn't think it mattered, and I just started announcing my new sobriety date, which by this point, can I just tell you, had been so long, I didn't know what it was. So my sobriety date's December 31st, 2001. It's an educated guess. I picked it so I don't forget it. I think it's important to have one. I went back and, like, you know, looked at the calendar and tried to figure it out, and I'm going to go with that's pretty close, maybe a week off, but nonetheless. And I started going through the steps with her, and I started getting involved, and, like, I started to feel better. Like, this program works when you're working it. But I've been in so many places where I'm not working it, and I'm shut off from God, and I'm not having that conscious contact. And, like, I'm a miserable, miserable person. And by the grace of God, I didn't pick up a drink after that last time where I had that experience. And I don't know. It got to a point where it talks in the big book, like, we continue to grow in understanding and effectiveness. I kind of just felt like that was where I was. I went through all, you know, the steps with my sponsor, and I started getting involved with a little bit more of the mainstream AA in Las Vegas, and I found a lady that I really liked, and I asked her to be my sponsor. And it's completely changed my life. She holds me accountable today. I call her every day, whether I want to or not, every single day. You know, and she calls me out on my shit. And I think it's really important to have somebody that holds you accountable, because I was, like, queen of unaccountability before. I didn't know how to show up. I didn't know how to do the things, you know, that, like, normal people know how to do. And it's just been a crazy ride. I'm no longer, you know, I'm divorced from my husband. He's still out there. I hope one day he makes it back. Maybe he's not really an alcoholic. I'll never really know. I have a job that I didn't even want, because God knows what's best for me. And I took the job kicking and fighting, and it's turned into a career that I'll probably be with, you know, for as long as I'm working. And I just get to have these cool experiences, you know, that, like, Carrie Ann's will is not the best. And if I show up and I try and align my will with God's will, like, everything usually works out. And I don't know, I know how to show up to work on time today. Like, that's a big thing. I was always late. And my manager appreciates me, and, like, for some of you, maybe you always went to work, and that's not a big deal, but, like, for me, that's kind of a big deal. And I don't know, I'm just really grateful to be here. It was an honor to be asked to speak, and I think that's all I have, so thanks.
Thank you very much, Carrie Ann. Our final speaker is from Tucson, here locally. Help me welcome Bob. Woo!
I'm Bob. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bob. We love you, Bob. Lots and lots and lots. In whole bunches.
Thank you. I love you, too. How in the world do you talk that fast? I can't even think that. I'm usually the oldest person in this convention. This time at 73, and my story is just like everything that you've heard up to this point, so I'm not going to take a whole long time. I'm going to, in fact, set this down in front of me so I don't get too long-winded. My story is about being sober for a long time and then going out, and then struggling for a long time to get back, and almost dying. and then coming back. My sobriety date currently is January 21st of 1995. My original time with AA was in the early 70s in Michigan. I was born and raised in a place called Grosse Pointe. My only claim to fame in this whole lifetime is that I lived with my grandparents. My grandfather was a close friend of Henry Ford's and a supplier of his during the war for airplane parts. And I had to take an automobile trip across country when I was very small with seven people, with my grandmother, with my grandfather, my mother, and myself, and the guy who invented the car we were riding in, and the guy who invented the tires that were, the pneumatic tires that were on the car we were riding in, and the guy who invented the electric bulbs in the headlights, and a former president of the United States. And somehow or another, my life has always been around the rich and famous somehow or another, but I've never had anything myself. I don't understand that. If you believe in karma, I do. But to get to the point, I started drinking very, very early, very young, because I was one of those kids that was very, very uncomfortable, scared of everybody and everything. The first classroom that I walked into when I was small was an absolute nightmare, because they knew something I didn't know. I knew that. I could tell by the way they looked. And those little brats could color inside lines, you know, all that stuff. it was that way all the time, just so self-conscious, so self-centered, you know. I didn't know that at the time. And fearful. And it went on like that until I found alcohol. When I found the first good hit full of booze, it was almost like we call a spiritual experience. I mean, all of that just went away. It just smoothed right off. You know, it just left me, like you described your experience with it. And I thought, boy, I didn't realize it at the time, but I developed kind of a crush on that experience. Just like you would on the first love affair, you know what I mean? That first crush where you get that, it becomes an obsession in your mind and you can't think of anything else. You bump into things and you can't sleep right, can't do anything because you're in love, you know. That was the effect, the sort of a romantic feeling I had toward that booze. And when you have that kind of an experience with something, you're not gonna put it down and forget it. So every chance I got where I could get some, I got it. And it went on and got heavier and heavier. I graduated from the Grosse Pointe High School, went to the University of Michigan. At Michigan, there was an ornate frame down one old hallway in Old Main there in Ann Arbor. There was a huge picture of a guy with his name Bob, his middle name, his last name, and MD behind it. And it said co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because it had pictures of famous people that had made something of themselves, you know, graduates from there. And it was a funny thing. I went back in 2002, I think it was, I went back for a visit. I saw Ohio State beating up on the Wolverines, which I didn't like very well. But while I was there, I went back to look at that picture because I had realized by this time that that was a real bad anonymity break, the way they had that. And sure enough, when I looked at the picture this time, it said simply Bob S., co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they had changed the plaque underneath. So, anyway, before I graduated, I met a girl from Kentucky. Graduated from Michigan in 1960, and she was pregnant. And I took her home, and I thought, I don't know what made me think I could convince them that everything was going to be okay if I married her. My grandfather just went right through the ceiling, and the hole is still there. And he said, people in this family do not act as irresponsibly as this. You're a drunkard, for Christ's sake. This is unacceptable. What I want you to do is take her and take all your things and get the hell out of here and don't even come back to visit. You're done. So I wound up no place to go with all my stuff out of God. But it was an adventure, you know, and she and I started, and I'm going to try and race through this and just get over this. We drank together at first, and then my drinking very soon became a problem, a bad one. She had two kids when we got married, and we had three of our own. But we told them that God decides who your parents are, and blood doesn't matter, and so I've always considered all of them my children. Never treated any of them differently. But I treated all of them badly because it wasn't available to them, and the drinking got worse and worse. They started hanging out in a neighbor's home where we had no idea there were drugs and alcohol going on there. And that there was some abuse going on between the stepchildren and the other children. And there was some hideous stuff going on, all kinds of. So when I finally did get sober, there was an awful lot of damage that had been done. And I got sober in 1981 here in Tucson. And the first, I don't know, six, maybe two or three years was great. I really enjoyed everything. And then my employer sent me to Los Angeles to work. And while I was there, I got involved in Clancy's group out there. And that was exciting and fun, and I enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun. I told people Clancy sponsored me. He really didn't sponsor me, but I called him every week and talked to him about what it boiled down to. Because the minute that I joined that group, I got transferred from City of Ministry back to San Bernardino. And was so far away that I could only get to the big meeting Wednesday night and to the meeting at the Santa Monica College on Saturday night. And sometimes to the one in Century City on Thursday night. And to the yard a couple of times to rake up goat crap and play ball and do stuff like that. I came back, the contract ended out there. I did make a lot of money, enough to retire on, actually, while I was out there. I made huge money. But I was still afraid of Los Angeles. It was so big and so crazy, you know, and things so intense. All the traffic and everything and the people was too much. So I moved back to Tucson. One of Clancy's last remarks was, you go back to the desert with the rest of those lizards and snakes, you'll be just fine. They in Southern California, they cannot understand anybody wanting to leave there. You know, they just couldn't get it. But anyway, I came back here, and what had been pretty good sobriety turned bad as soon as I got back here, because I suddenly got full of myself and decided I was going to be little fancy and teach Tucson how to do AA properly. And began speaking a lot and sponsoring a lot of people and just carrying on, and I failed to enlarge my spiritual life. I heard that read earlier, and that was my downfall right there. And when I went out, I got so ill right away, so sick, both mentally and physically, I lost the ability to work and wound up on the street here in Tucson. And for 3.5 years, and became an almost permanent resident of that old dirty detox down there, across from St. Mary's Hospital. None of you are old enough to remember that, you know. But they knew that something was wrong aside from just the drinking, because I did have some mental difficulties, psychiatric problems. And they started sending me around and giving me help, and I finally found somebody that understood what was going on and helped me to get my mind straightened back out again. And then I wanted to be sober really bad, and I didn't know how to go about doing it. And they started they understood what was going on curiously there at the LARC. And they kept me, they took a liking to me somehow, and they kept me in there. They had what they call a safe harbor program, where they keep you in there for several months. And they broke their own rules and kept me in there for months and months and months at a time, up to 9 months once. So it dawned on me after this was all over that I had never gone without a meal on a single day. Most every day I'd had a roof over my head, one way or another, being homeless. And even though I was 123 pounds at the time, if you think I'm skinny now, and long, long, dirty hair, and just awful. But I finally got cleaned up and got they had applied for Social Security, and I hadn't realized that, and all of a sudden I got these huge checks through the mail, and decided to move to Savannah, Georgia, which is a gem of a city, beautiful place. And I moved there and got drunk as soon as I arrived there. That was in January of 95. And tripped and fell on a curb and cut and banged my face up and broke my glasses. Had these huge checks from Social Security with me and no ID. No way to cash them. And so I went to the only place I knew to go to was the AA club. It was called the 24-Hour Club there. It was a beautiful place. It sat out in this wooded area. I got there real early on a Sunday morning, actually on the 21st of January. And the sunlight was glistening down through those tall trees. It was just really a beautiful setting. And I just lost it somehow. And I had been reading in the big book, Bill's story, where he had described that there was quicksand all around him. He was just so depressed he was suicidal the night before. But he woke up in the morning for some reason, and he remembered the talk with Abby in the kitchen, and he remembered those spiritual feelings that he had had earlier in his life. And he says, "I just offered myself to God as I then understood him, do with me as whatever he would, and admitted for the first time that of myself I am nothing, and without him I'm lost." And I read those words, and I just dropped the book, and I started screaming at God. I said, "You know, you can take me right now or you can leave me here. I don't care if I ever have anything or anybody in my life again. I just need something from you right now. I need to know that you're there." And he answered it instantly. I got filled with a very, very deep sense of peace. And I got a feeling of being connected somehow with everything that I was looking at. It was like everything felt interconnected, and I realized all of a sudden that in God's world, that's how all of us are connected together. Everything really is interconnected in this universe. Because we're seeing it very darkly, we're only seeing a small fraction of reality as it really is. So I had that experience, and then thank God I found this old guy with a big book under his arm that same afternoon. And he brought me down from that a little bit. He told me, "You know," and he realized, "that's not going to keep you sober." It was a real lovely experience. I'm glad you had it, but that won't keep you sober, because alcoholics have the greatest forgetter in the world. As time goes along, that will wear away. that experience, because you need to make some internal changes, and you only do that by taking actions. So if you're willing to, I'll go through the big book with you, and we'll just simply do everything that it says to do. So we did that. We went through the book. We did everything that it said to do. He made sure I understood the meaning of words. He had a dictionary as well. He pointed out all the promises, and you know there's promises in almost every page of that book. Around every step there are promises, not just the 12 ones that we read. Anything they said that they did and got a result from, the result they got is a promise that we'll get if we do the same thing. And he was right. Before we got just a few months into that, I felt myself changing inside. And this has been a great, great experience ever since. A couple of years later, I moved back to Tucson. I just felt called to come back here for some reason or another. And ever since, I've been working with people, and then I found a new sponsor who put me on the 11th step. He knew I was working. He knew I was working with people, and he knew I had just been through the steps. So he had me reading those pages 85 through 88 every day, and going to an 11th step meeting. And he wanted me to be still. That was his favorite saying: be still and know. He wanted me to have quiet time every morning and every night, and then also do the instructions that are in the 11th step. He explained that that is the AA way of life right there in the 10th and 11th step. If we're not doing that, we're not living the AA way of life, really. We're not following all those instructions. That was the way he put it. That's pretty extreme. But I believed him, and I started doing that every morning and every night. I've been doing that for 14 years. And I've been able to feel and really experience the presence of God in my life. I've been able to see it work and help to heal others. My favorite thing in the world right now is working with others. And sponsoring quite a few people. And now they're sponsoring people, so I have grandbabies running around. And all of that is my life just feels so good. It feels good to wake up in the morning, even at 73. And I'm really happy to be here with you. I've always loved the young people in AA. I've always loved. In fact, there's a meeting coming up later called Youth Enjoying Sobriety. My youngest daughter, who is now 45, got sober a little over 20 years ago in Youth Enjoying Sobriety. That was before ASCII Power, technically. That was the forerunner. So I've let her know that that meeting is here today. She's working, but she's doing the 9/11 line. But she carries the phone around with her, so she may be able to get here. In case there's some early friends of hers there. And there are three of the other kids now are sober, clean too. And all of that damage has been repaired. I followed my sponsor's instructions and made amends over and over again without ever referring to the past, without ever saying I'm sorry. What I did in the beginning was just send them a note every month. Something to the effect that I'm sober now in AA, and I'm feeling better, and I'm thinking about you, love, Dad. And just, you can change the wording around a little bit, but just say basically that every month, and don't expect an answer. Just send it. And on the 12th month, I got a postcard from my eldest daughter, who was the one who had run away from home at 16. I hadn't seen her for 12 years. She said, Dad, I understand you're celebrating a birthday. I'd like to come and stay with you. And that was the beginning. That's where the healing began. Once the kids saw the sobriety, that they saw their dad as a different person, they could begin to forgive. and they've even seen so much value in forgiveness that they've forgiven each other. So we have one big happy family. And Alcoholics Anonymous. So you young people are the future of AA, remember that. Once you get past your 20s, I'll tell you, life starts to go pretty fast. That's part of this grand illusion that we're in here. And you're going to be the old timer one of these days. You're going to be the people that do the sponsoring, people that become the delegates and do all the responsible things in AA. You're the ones who are going to do it. I love you. I won't be like Clancy. He says, you young people are the future of AA. That's why the old timers are glad we're going to be dead. And I'll leave you with that. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Here to read a vision for you, help me welcome Francisco.
Good morning. My name is Francisco. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Hi, Francisco. We love you, Francisco. Lots and lots and lots in whole bunches.
A vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask God in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with God is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you. Thank you. And can I get another hand for everybody who read today or shared? Thank you very much. Please help me join hands and close the meeting with the Serenity Prayer.